Okay, so today on the Loopcast, I have Rob Farley with me, the author of Grounded, the Case for Abolishing the United States Air Force. So this is it's a fairly controversial book, and we wanted to get Rob on the show to discuss it, because, I mean, it's a controversial book. I mean, if you followed sort of Twitter and Facebook, and even sort of War on the Rocks, it's elicited a lot of feelings from people and a lot of sort of argumentative umbrage, or I don't even know what to call it, but it's controversial, and I think you should read it, because, I mean, even if you don't agree with the thesis, as you know, we'll discuss it here, I think it is an exercise in critical thought and an exercise in sort of trying to understand, you know, the role of the Air Force, you know, and the role of sort of what the Air Force is in sort of modern times. And I think it is definitely, well, you know, if you're a student of strategy or a student of the military, this is definitely something to read and sort of get you thinking and sort of looking at it in a new light. So I want to first start off with, you know, what was sort of your motive and your sort of inspiration for writing this book? I mean, I'm sorry, I sort of pair motive and inspiration together, but what was sort of your reasoning behind sort of writing this book?
Well, you know, about first, thanks for having me on. I'm looking forward to, you know, talking. I know a lot of people in the audience, a lot of people who've done this show before, and so it's a great opportunity to be here. Inspiration for at least, you know, starting to think about this book was way back around 2000, where I attended a conference, really more of a working session that went on for about 3 weeks called SWAMOS, which is, I want to say, Strategic Workshop something. Anyway, Dick Betts, Steve Rosen, Steve Biddle put it together, Elliot Cohen put it together, and it drags a bunch of political scientists up to Ithaca, New York, which is gorgeous in the summer. And we talk about military affairs, and what it's supposed to do is to turn people like me who study political science and security affairs into people who actually know something about the military. And it was there that I first began to become aware of how bitter the rancor was between the Army and the Air Force over interpretations of what happened in Operation Desert Storm in 1991. You know, I had never, like, sort of fully understood that there was, you know, this wide gulf of interpretation between the two services about who had won the war, about the relative contributions that each had made, about the expectations that each had for what their respective forces would do. And so starting from there, you know, over the years, I became more and more interested in studying these debates and conversations between air power and ground power. And in my reading, discovered that effectively, after and during every war that we fought since World War II, there has been this same bitter, rancorous conflict between air power advocates and land power advocates over who did what, who bears the primary responsibility for victory, what the central contribution to victory was. And so that made me very interested in air power, in air forces, in strategic air power, and how air forces define themselves. And so then, believe it or not, in a conversation with Matt Iglesias over beers one evening in D.C., he suggested that I write an article about abolishing the Air Force. And so I wrote one for the American Prospect in 2007, and then that, through a bunch of twists and turns, led to the book. You know, my academic interests have very much been in, and were even before 2000, they were in organizational theory about how organizations learn, about how organizations compete with one another, about how they fight for influence. My advisor was at the University of Washington, was Elizabeth Keir, who wrote a very good book on how the Royal Air Force learned before World War II, and also how the French Army failed to learn before World War II. And so that put me in sort of an organizational mindset to approach the question of the Army and the Air Force and the Navy as essentially gigantic bureaucracies, and then to try to sort through what are the perversities that a particular organizational constellation creates? And so what are the perversities that an Air Force creates, an independent Air Force as opposed to an Air Force that's part of another service? And so that's basically how I got to at least starting to think about the question in the way that I've been thinking about it.
So, I mean, can you sort of, you know, outline the thesis of the book for us? Because I think, you know, I think it's the thesis that sort of is really interesting and sort of, excuse me, is really sort of what has promoted sort of a sense of controversy among the, you know, the critics.
Right. The thesis is that the United States absolutely needs air power because air power is part of every significant conception of how we conduct military operations, anything at the tactical level, anything at the strategic level. So air power is absolutely critical to any vision of American military performance in the future. But that to have air power, we don't necessarily need an independent air force, a bureaucratically independent, politically effective air force. And in fact, that having an air force, having a particular service that's dedicated to air power, may be counterproductive in terms of having a integrated, joint, to use the military parlance, vision of how we prepare for war, of how we think about war, of how we procure technology for war, and finally, and I don't know if this is most important, but how we actually conduct war, that the way we go about fighting, that having an independent air force may not actually be a productive organizational institutional option for all of these questions, right? That you can think of different configurations of institutions. And so my argument is that what we should do is go back to the situation or something very similar to the situation that we had before 1947 and return significant assets that the Air Force currently holds to the U.S. Army, shift other assets over to the United States Navy, and move forward with a two-service model in which aviation is a part of an integrated way of warfighting. And sort of strategic shaping that each service has.
That's interesting. So, I mean, before we get into sort of the gritty of the book, I'm sort of curious, why do you think this book has been so controversial? Because, you know, while I was going through this afternoon, going through sort of reading the reviews and reading what people have said on Twitter, just, holy crow, like, I've never seen, maybe I've been out of academia for so long, but people were sort of really rankled by your book. I mean, you know, just using the War on the Rocks review,
right.
it took like seven guys to sort of write a response, which was, I don't think I've ever seen that before.
Right, and I actually think that characterizing it as a response rather than a review is the more appropriate description of that particular piece. It sort of seemed like they were reviewing the cover of the title. Rather than the book itself, but anyway, I digress.
But I mean, why do you think it's so controversial? I mean, it seems like, you know, going through the book, it didn't seem, at least to an outsider like me, it didn't seem that controversial, and it was just sort of, you know, discussing and sort of arguing for another way of thinking and another way of conceptualization. But, you know, why do you think the response has been so strong thus far?
I mean, I guess framing it in two ways. First, there is, you know, the book is called Grounded, The Case for Abolishing the United States Air Force. It has a picture of a bunch of cut-up airplanes on the cover. That's going to, you know, it's intended to be alarming. It's intended to be provocative. I don't want to sort of be one of these people who says, "Oh, hey, at least I touched a nerve," because that's sort of the coward's way out of writing a provocative argument and then not backing it up. But it is designed to be controversial and to spur some sort of conversation. And in this context, we're talking about a conversation with an organization that has, you know, if you include the reserve, 600,000 people who are dedicated around the the maintenance and continuation and really the excellence of American air power. And so there's a, you know, a pretty clear implication, again, just looking at the cover, that these 600,000 people are not doing the job the right way, and maybe they should be in different jobs, and maybe potentially they shouldn't be in any jobs at all. And that also is extremely threatening, and it's understandable why people are threatened about it. And I think it's a very honest, very sensible reaction for people to be threatened by that argument. You know, I think that there's another part of it too, and you know, there are a bunch of people who've got at this in various ways. I think Colin Gray has touched on it. I think that Dave Johnson at Rand has touched on it, and it's that advocates of an independent air force, both in the United Kingdom and in the United States, but perhaps especially in the United States, have a lingering sense of paranoia. That stems all the way back to the fight for independence. I just read this interesting book on Billy Mitchell's war. It's titled Billy Mitchell's War Against the Navy. And it talked a lot about how, Billy Mitchell was an unpleasant human being. Basically, part, he shot his wife, a bunch of other stuff. His role and his role in advocacy definitely sort of looks like somebody with a chip on their shoulder. And there seems to be sort of some element of that still in this sort of sense of insecurity. Now, to put a frame it a different way, if I wrote a book called Scuttled, the Case for Abolishing the United States Navy, I literally don't think anyone would pay any attention to it. I mean, it would just, it would just roll off the shoulders of Navy personnel. They would be utterly indifferent to this case, and they wouldn't be threatened by it. They just wouldn't care. And I think there's something a little bit different about the Air Force and the position that the Air Force has, sort of intellectually within the U.S. defense establishment, that there's still this lingering sense left over from the nasty fight that led to Air Force independence, and that led to some of the more problematic aspects of sort of when the Air Force was independent, that make people really touchy about this argument. And so I guess that's why we've seen so many responses to it, which are really angry. But, I'd also at the same time say most of these responses, and I wouldn't necessarily include the War on the Rocks response in this, but most of these responses have been productive and have engaged with the argument. And that's been a good thing for me and a good thing for the book.
So I want to sort of get into the book's arguments. Now, you made this sort of argument of a two-service model where you have, if I understand it correctly, you would get rid of the Air Force and then sort of the personnel would go to the Army and then the Navy, which would then have their own sort of air component, I guess, would right. Sort of how I explain it. But what would you, sort of explain to us the idea of an independent air force versus a dependent air force, and sort of the three service model versus the two service model?
Right. In the American context and in the British context, and these are the sort of the two most important, most famous independent air forces, what we're talking about when we are talking about the difference between a branch, sort of an Army Aviation branch, which Army Aviation has, and a Naval Aviation branch, which the Navy has, and a service, is really sort of the access that a particular organization has to political power. That when you decide to make an independent air force, basically what you're doing is you are creating political protection for a particular set of capabilities. And you're protecting those capabilities from other organizations so that nobody can ever again decide as an internal decision that, you know what, planes don't matter, submarines are what matters, and we are basically going to ditch naval aviation, right? Or on the other hand, tanks are what matters now, that planes have become irrelevant because of lasers or something, and so we're going to ditch aviation, right? That when you create an independent service, what you're doing is saying, those kinds of decisions have to go through the political system. They have to go through Congress, and they have to go through the executive. Now, not all. I mean, the services have ways of, or Congress has ways of intervening in internal service decisions, right? Which is why we still have an A-10, because the Air Force would have killed the A-10 a long time ago if they could have. But that's basically what we're talking about when we're talking about an independent service, one that is protected and has its own political lobby and political influence. And, you know, my argument is that it's just wrong to think about air power in context of something that is endangered by other ways of thinking about warfighting. And that whereas it may be true to some extent that ground-bound artillery officers in 1919 did not fully appreciate the contribution that aviation could make. And I say might be because I'm not even sure I really believe that, but it might be true that it's certainly not true anymore. And so when we're thinking about aviation, we should think about it as something that is part of the general mix of capabilities that a particular service has. And so we should be able to approach it on an equivalent basis as with something like armor and infantry and the undersea, the submarine arm, and the surface arm. And that the basic mix of aviation capabilities with other capabilities should be something that we can debate on an internal service level rather than on the political level.
And so I want to add the idea of strategy or strategic versus tactical air power to sort of this discussion. I mean, walk us through what you would consider strategic air power versus sort of tactical air power, so to speak.
Right. I mean, Colin Gray has a wonderful explanation, and he has a wonderful maxim, which is that all air power is strategic, and he's right, that, you know, even if you're using your Air Force to do nothing but to destroy enemy tanks, that has a strategic impact, right? That has sort of a broader effect on how the outcome of war and a broader effect on the sort of the way that that nations interact. But the way that aviators have defined this question, and the way, in fact, that it was institutionally defined in the United States Army Air Force and in the United States Air Force, and even really in the sort of the various Soviet air forces, there's this distinction between strategic air power on the one hand, and strategic air power is oriented around sort of quite clearly the idea that air power can have independent decisive effect in warfare. So this is the part of the service that is designed to fly over enemy armies, avoiding conflict with them, to destroy the centers of government, to destroy the economy, to destroy society, and then to win a war without disarming the enemy. And this has been how, broadly speaking, aviators have defined strategic air power through history. This is part of the big strategic bombing campaigns of World War II, but it's also, it goes all the way down to John Warden, and to a lesser extent John Boyd, but certainly John Warden. Whereas tactical air power is all of these things that we envision as support activities. And support activities are close air support is the most obvious, but also interdiction, theater transport, some parts of air superiority, and most all that the Navy does, that naval air power and that or the naval aviation and the marine aviation do, are usually defined under tactical. Although I would say that, you know, there's a lot of naval aviation that could be defined under strategic, but. And so this, sort of broadly speaking, is this distinction between strategic and tactical, that strategic is about winning a war with just air power, and tactical is about how air power can support the operations, how air power supports the joint fight, essentially. And so that's the distinction. Now, do you want me to get into, like, how that matters for Air Force independence, or...
I do. I'm sort of curious. I mean, you know, how does it work now, and how would it work under your sort of your argument of abolishing the Air Force?
Right. You know, historically, the aviators, especially in the U.S. and the U.K., have in pursuit and in maintenance of the independence of the Air Force have focused on the strategic mission, right? Have focused on the notion that strategic air power is what can win us a independence, right? It can win wars, but it could also win independence. In the modern context, and this is especially true after the Gulf War, you had sort of, and so after Vietnam, a lot of the bomber pilots who had essentially run the Air Force after World War II retired, and you had something called The Rise of the Fighter Generals, which is in fact the name of a book, which is an excellent book, and I heartily recommend it to everyone. And the Air Force under the fighter generals who were associated with TAC Air became much more tactical in orientation and much more interested in the support of especially the Army, but also to some extent the Navy. And this led to air-land battle. Led to a battlefield air interdiction, sort of a series of concepts that were designed around the integration of air and naval power. Or air and land power. So this begins to change after the Cold War ends, and this begins to change in the wake of Gulf War I, where there's sort of there's this reinvention of the notion that air power can, in and of itself, be decisive, that it can win wars of its own accord. Without being in support of ground, or without even really cooperation with ground forces. And this is sort of epitomized in sort of the famous argument that went down between Bob Horner and John Morden, basically, in 1990 about the set of options to provide to Norman Schwarzkopf. And Morden wanted to provide an option that would have involved just a brief air campaign against Saddam Hussein's command and control facilities with the intentional leaving of Saddam Hussein's army, the Iraqi army, in control of Kuwait. And this also is sort of reflected in how the Kosovo War was fought and how it was conceptualized. And so even though a lot of the debates about can air power be independent and decisive by itself seem like they were answered in either 1945 or in 1972, they are still recurring. And you're still seeing them recur even now. You recently saw there was a Ben Lambeth article. I want to say it was Airline Reversal, something along those lines, which kind of tried to make a similar argument, although I think wrongheadedly. I guess one way of phrasing it is that the idea that strategic air power can be that independent strategic air power can be decisive is built into the DNA of our modern Air Force, of the United States Air Force, and is going to recur. It's going to recur consistently, even if at any particular time the Air Force is focused on tactical support of land and sea. That it's part of how the Air Force gained independence, it's part of how the Air Force conceptualized itself, and it's going to come back. And that the best way to inoculate against it, because I think that it's built on a set of faulty assumptions, is to remove the political support for the Air Force, right? To fold it into the other two services so that you don't have a political lobby for this kind of strategic air power.
So I'm sort of interested in playing out what happens when you fold the Air Force into the Army and into the Navy. Moreover, I want to sort of focus on the idea of that it seems like the current setup, each one focuses on their own domain. So you have the Army focuses on land operations, the Navy focuses on ocean and littoral operations. And I'm simplifying before anybody decides to troll. And the Air Force focuses on sort of air. So I'm sort of curious. I mean, what happens if your plan was to go forward? Let's say it does. What happens to the expertise that the Air Force has? Expertise has knowledge on sort of controlling the airspace and sort of being able to engage in operations within that airspace. I mean, what happens if you were to fold it within into the Army and into the Navy?
You know, part of my answer is that I don't believe the argument that only an independent Air Force can develop proud, innovative, well-trained aviators. And I think that we have a couple organizations really that sort of put the lie to that perspective. One of them is the United States Navy, which has, you know, just not only outstanding aviators, but an extraordinarily sophisticated understanding of air power and how air power not only serves the fleet, but serves the broader strategic objectives of the United States. You know, people undoubtedly will find this controversial, but you know, I think that the way that the Navy has approached the use of, say, not only the F-35C, but also of unmanned aerial vehicles in air superiority combat is much more complex and sophisticated than Air Force thinking on the same subject. And the other organization which I would point to just right off the top of my head would be the Israeli Air Force, which is part of broader Israeli Defense Forces, and which is renowned beyond question for the capabilities of its aviators and the excellence of it, not only of its pilots, but its maintenance and everything else associated with air power. And so that's part of the answer, that you can have outstanding excellence, however the Simpsons went, an award for excellence in the field of outstanding or outstanding in the field of excellence, even without an independent Air Force. And the second way I would answer it is that, you know, we have to evaluate the contributions of an independent Air Force on the historical record. And when you look at what the air-minded independent Air Force has managed in the 70 years since its inception, yeah, they came up with the Century series of fighters, which is terrible. They're all terrible. They're all terrible fighters. They came up with terrible training in the Vietnam War, where effectively aviators were being schooled by North Vietnamese pilots in MiG-21s and planes that they should have dominated. And this is the service that's supposed to be dedicated to air power excellence. They came up with contraptions like the B-36, which is such a beautiful aircraft and was obsolete before it flew, it flew 5 feet. The B-58, which had a loss rate which rivaled the loss rate of World War II bombers without ever having actually dropped a bomb on anyone. And so I guess for these two reasons combined, I'm skeptical that for excellence in air power, what you really need is an independent air service. I think you can probably manage with something more similar to what the Navy has put together in its aviation branch.
Then I'm sort of curious. I mean, what happens to the logistical tail? I know this seems nitpicky, but it seems like the Air Force is a billion-dollar, hundreds of billions of dollars of equipment, mm-hmm. and then you're folding it into the Army and into the Navy. So what happens to logistics in terms of supply, and then logistics in terms of acquisition? I mean. Do you run the risk of sort of reproducing the inefficiencies that, we sort of see with the Air Force and sort of just moving those, inefficiencies into, into the Army and into the Navy?
The interesting part of that question is that we are already seeing, partially as a result of sort of the long-term effects of Goldwater-Nichols, but also of the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, we're already seeing an effort to render the logistical problem joint, right? People are recognizing that you know, the logistics is a significant issue, and so, but that at the same time, a lot of logistical requirements don't necessarily have to be service-based in the way that they have been over the past 70 years. I mean, this, you know, it's not the only reason that we have the F-35, but it's a reason we have the F-35. The idea that that the Air Force, the Navy, and the Marine Corps all having what is effectively the same aircraft really simplifies maintenance. It simplifies training. It simplifies logistics and parts and the transitions to parts and everything else. So, you know, I mean, on the logistical front, I think that we are already seeing a transition to a joint model rather than a service-oriented model. And so in that sense, I think actually the logistical side of it is way ahead of the point of the spear part of it in terms of thinking about integration versus separate services. That integration of capabilities is sort of the way to go, the way to reduce costs, the way to increase effectiveness, and sort of more generally the way to develop a more efficient warfighting machine.
So I want to sort of get into this idea that, you know, within your introduction of your book, I think in the beginning, you know, you argue, you know, you have the bureaucratic sort of impetus, you have, you know, the acquisition influence, and I think your strongest argument struck me as the political, sort of the political interests outside of the Air Force. And so I'm sort of quoting from your book here. Political interest groups focused on parochial air power. You know, the idea that decisiveness, you know, air power can win victories more quickly. That air power has a sort of decisiveness. Can you sort of go into the sort of the nature of this group and sort of what you identify as this political group that is sort of has attached itself to air power as being a decisive instrument of policy?
Right. I mean, I think that sort of reflecting on the argument there, it would be better to speak of it in terms of a sort of broad coalition of different actors with different interests who sort of come together around the idea of decisive and relatively cheap and relatively painless air power, right? And, you know, this includes, I guess, sort of on the one end of the scale, one part of this coalition is the Air Force itself, right? The Air Force itself, which is constituted almost entirely of people who think that aviation is awesome, who think that the Air Force and an Air Force career is a deeply patriotic service to our country, and they're right about that, who believe that what they're doing is, you know, absolutely the most effective way to serve their country, and who are therefore going to consistently advocate for air power-oriented options as opposed to options that are sort of more joint. So that's one part of the coalition. Another part of the coalition are what, you know, I don't know exactly how to phrase them, but I mean, you might call them your New Republic liberal, right? And they might be well-defined under people who sort of think about the role of the United States in foreign affairs in a very activist and positive way and believe that the United States military has an activist role to play in has an important role to play within this activist framework, and so, you know, these are the people who would argue for no fly zone over Syria, no fly zone over, I'm not sure if anybody's argued for a no fly zone over Crimea, but you know, who, you know, they might as well, no fly zone over Libya or whatever, right? Where air power flatters a certain sensibility about the use of U.S. power, where the U.S. America can shape outcomes around the world in ways that are cheap, that are non-intrusive, that don't necessarily require Americans to be endangered or Americans to be on the ground, but that nevertheless can be decisive, right? And so the idea of independent power is very attractive to sort of your new republic or even your sort of Washington Post liberal hawk who really wants to do some good in the world, but doesn't want to put U.S. troops somewhere where they're going to be harmed. And air power is just the fantastic answer to that. All right, let's. Assad is gassing people. Well, I know what can take care of that: B-2s and cruise missiles. And this is a perspective which obviously is deeply frustrating to a lot of people. And then, sort of the third part of the coalition is sort of what you would expect, right? People who, you know, take a step beyond the New Republic liberal and sort of and move more into firmly what has been termed by themselves and by others as the neoconservative camp. A firm belief in American exceptionalism, firm belief in the not only justice but the capability of the United States to affect outcomes around the world, and following up on that, the belief that the United States ought to intervene in as many places as we can and as effectively as we can, and air power gives us that opportunity. So the idea of global strike, global reach, global power is sort of a mantra. Not only to the air power people on the one hand, but also to sort of very firm believers in American, a positive view of American hegemony.
I mean, it almost seems like what you've outlined is a disconnect between policymakers and the use of air power, because it almost seems like they have this very fantastical construction of how to use an air force or how to use air power, and there's sort of a disconnect between that construction and reality. I mean, going through it, I mean, would bombing Assad really have stopped him using chemical weapons? Does bombing Assad really stop the use of artillery? So I mean, is there a sort of disconnect between the people who sort of advocate for air power in decisiveness as a decisive form of action and sort of reality?
There is a disconnect, and I think that there are a lot of these features of air power that we've talked about that are just in the abstract extraordinarily attractive to civilians, right? And civilian policymakers, senior civilian policymakers, who sort of the United States political system being what it is, and sort of correctly being what it is, doesn't require military experience, right? Doesn't require, a firm investigation and sort of a deep investigation of the cost and benefits of different kinds of uses of military force. I don't want to point to the Clinton administration in particular on this, but from time, but the Clinton administration does sort of seem to be the epitome of this, right? A set of political actors not particularly interested in the nuts and bolts of military affairs, but who wanted to do good things in the world. And air power was there, right? It was there as a tool. People were telling them that it was an important, relevant tool. People were telling them that it was something that could do good things and could do good things in the way that they wanted to do good things, which was with small footprint, which was with not many attacks, with no civilians dying. And so I would say, yeah, there is this. It's symptomatic of the broader disconnect between military and civilian affairs, but there is this disconnect between the very serious debates about and very complex debates on the military and military history side about what air power can do and the options that are offered to civilian policymakers who might have an interest in solving problems through the use of military force.
So I want to sort of transition. So we've talked about grounded. I want to sort of transition to the future of the Air Force, and I think it sort of fits in with the Loopcast's our discussion of technology in modern world.
Right.
And I'm sort of curious. I want to start with a broad question, and we'll sort of get into specifics. where do drones fit in all this? I mean, it almost seems like drones have the ability to sort of reproduce the same problems that you sort of brought up, but at the same time, you know, they almost seem to an outsider as something new and something novel. You know, it's a robot with wings and missiles.
Right.
But I mean, you know, where do we fit in drones, and or where do you fit in drones into your sort of your argument?
Right. I mean, it's a you know, it's a the drone chapter was the last chapter written, and it was written at the correctly, really, at the behest of my editors, who said, you know, you really need to talk about drones at a greater extent. You know, I had drones as a branch, and they wanted me to turn drones into a service, and so I turned drones into a service. But there are, I think, so many misconceptions about drones and about the relationship of the Air Force with drones I am under a state of constant frustration. I think a lot of people are this way on Twitter, a state of constant frustration about exactly how we think about drones. The way I think of what I want to position drones and I want to think about drones is to position them within the context of classical and neoclassical air power theory, right? That there's nothing that much different about a drone than a B-17 or an F-16 that sort of really demands either extraordinary excitement or hysteria. Like it's just another airplane. And especially in the context of how we're fighting the wars in Afghanistan and other places, there is probably more of a chance that a drone pilot is going to die on the way home in a car accident than a B-1B pilot is going to die at the hands of a missile-operating Taliban soldier. And so there's sort of that, right, that we need to frame drones within the broader context of air power theory and think about them as, you know, just sort of tools of air power in the same way as we think about manned aircraft. And then there's the organizational case. And the organizational case is also really interesting because, and I, you know, it's been absolutely fantastic too. I wish that Secretary Gates' book had come out when I still had chance to cite it. Because Secretary Gates had, you know, fantastic discussions of how drones fit into Air Force and Army thinking. And he was really quite hostile to the Air Force perspective, and I think, you know, one of the things he argued was that this is a capability that the Air Force just doesn't care about, and they really want to control it, right? The sort of broadly indifferent to the whole idea of drones, but they want to make damn sure that the Army doesn't have it. And there have been so many similar capabilities over the course of independent Air Force history, you know, from light transport aircraft to close air support aircraft to even ICBMs, where there's been this disconnect between how this really fits into the aviator's vision of what the Air Force should be, and the threat that some other organization might really take over this capability. And it sort of brings air power theory and institutional dynamics and bureaucratic imperatives together. And so, you know, the story that interests me is, you know, the Air Force has taken a professional approach to drones. They have worked on them when asked. They have operated them, you know, not only competently but expertly. They have pursued capabilities when they've needed to, but they've never been enthusiastic about the drone in the way that some other organizations have been. And, you know, this is sort of part of the long-standing culture of the Air Force, which is very aviator-focused, very piloting-focused, you know, almost aesthetically focused in some sense. And so, you know, what it reinforces to me is that a system of military services that we are purportedly organizing around domains, ground, air, sea, which is a bald-faced lie from the start because we have six air forces. is just a very impoverished and incomplete way of thinking about military affairs. We give drones to the Air Force because they fly through the air. You know, really, I mean, is that really how we should think about taking this capability? Is that who's going to be using it? Is that going to be who can derive the most benefit from it? Is that going to be the most effective institutional solution to the problem of innovation in drones? No. I mean, I think a straightforward no is the answer. And so drones are a great example of how our sort of current organizational institutional framework fails us in terms of thinking about a new sort of a new technological vision.
I'm sort of curious, I mean, with any sort of new technology, I mean, is this sort of, you know, I hate to sort of phrase it this way, but the democratization of air force, of air power, democratization of air power. In the sense, when I say democratization, mm-hmm. I mean sort of the widespread use. I mean, it seems like, you know, I think you made a reference to the idea of six air forces that mm-hmm. you have the CIA with its own drones. You have, you know, the Army with its own drones. You have the Navy with its own drones. And now you have the Air Force with its own drones. I mean, does the introduction of this sort of relatively cheaper and easier to use technology make it sort of easier to spread and easier to use?
Yeah, that's a really interesting question. And I guess I would say that the real democratization of drone technology comes not in its spread within the sort of the federal military services, which had air forces before drones were around, right? The Army, the Navy, the Air Force, the Marines, the Coast Guard, and the CIA all had air forces before drones were invented. The real democratization of air power that drones bring about is sort of built upon and piggybacked upon the way that rotary aviation spread across the state and local elements of government in the country. So in some sense, it's not the spread among federal agents, it's the spread of drones to police forces, to immigration, to the EPA, to a variety of different small organizations that all require, almost every organization that comes up with a good idea for using drones literally has a good idea for using drones, whether it's to monitor wildlife. And Kelsey Atherton, a mutual friend, Kelsey, he has done work on how drones are used in protecting endangered species. And they are legitimately and effectively used for the protection of endangered species. And so, in some sense, it does seem like the democratization of air power. I mean, we at my school, the Patterson School at University of Kentucky, we actually thought about producing a Patterson drone at one point, which would have been just a basic remote control airplane. But we couldn't make it work from an iPad, which was also another one of our things, and so we didn't do it. But that too is sort of a democratization of air power, and it's even more of a democratization than the idea that every news station will have a helicopter, because there's really no reason for every news station to have a helicopter if every news station can have a drone. And so that is sort of a democratic, in some sense, approach to air power.
I'm sort of curious. I mean, what does this do with the relationship between the airman, the soldier of the Air Force, and the civilian? Because, I mean, it seems like you're almost sort of blending the two roles now, because a lot, as you said, a lot of this technology can also be found in the civilian space.
Right.
And really, in some cases, the only difference between what can be bought in the civilian space and the military space is putting a missile on a wing and maybe tweaking, some of the intelligence collecting capabilities. I mean, what does this do for, the role of the soldier, the airman versus a civilian? Let me even maybe complexify this further. Mm-hmm. A civilian as contractor too.
Right. I mean, this gets into a serious debates about the differences between conceptions of officership in the Air Force and conceptions of officership in the Army. And, you know, it's commonly sort of pointed out that only in the Air Force and in sort of the Naval Aviation Branch is it expected that the killers, the fighters, so the people who regularly kill people, are going to be officers. Right, it's sort of in the Army, in the Marine Corps, even in the Navy, where your gun operators, your weapon operators are often enlisted personnel. It's the enlisted who do the killing, and the officers who do the management of violence. And this has also been a point of dispute between the Army and the Air Force about sort of how expensive it is to maintain drones, because officers are more expensive than enlisted personnel. But yeah, it brings up a lot of really interesting questions, right? I mean, you can make a set of plausible arguments about whether your B-1B pilot or your B-2 pilot, this person who is flying a $2.6 billion piece of equipment, or however expensive it may be, or your F-35 pilot who's flying a $150 million, or however expensive it may be, piece of equipment, it needs to be somebody who has a four-year degree. And when you frame it in those terms, it really makes sense, right? Because you would never really want someone who's not sort of a really educated expert on a variety of things, engineering, everything else, to be in control of such a technology. But drones do really seem kind of different, right? And the democratization of the technology in this sense, that it's getting ever easier to use air power and even to conceive of air power in a lethal fashion, right? I mean, to the extent you start asking questions about what do we really need in terms of expertise from our aviators, and that's a problematic question for the Air Force. And by problematic, I don't mean that's a question they couldn't answer in a good way, because you can answer in a good way by potentially arguing that the stakes in air power are higher, and so you really do need the level of expertise on the sort of the killing decision in air power that you don't require in the other services. But it's a complicated question for air power, I think.
But I mean, to sort of build on your point, I mean, to be a pilot in an F-15 or F-35, don't you have to be, I'm assuming, a captain, a major, right, or a colonel, something where you've built a lot of experience and you've gone through the sort of the lieutenant position, and you're there for 10, 15 years before you can even get into a plane. Whereas it seems like with a drone, it's a kid straight out of, basic, maybe with more training, but it's not 10 to 15 years of experience and, practice. It's, maybe a year, 2 years, 3 years, and then you're sort of oriented to flying. So, I mean,
right,
is that creating tension, or do you see it creating tension within sort of more traditional Air Force culture, or whatever you want to sort of call it?
Yeah, well, I mean, first, you can become an aviator without 10 or 15 years of experience. So there are lieutenants who fly even F-15s. But there's also, there's a significant distinction with the Army, in the sense of where, with the Army, you build from being a lieutenant with a very small number of personnel to a captain with more, to a major with even more, all the way up to a colonel and brigadier general with even more. And that isn't quite replicated in the Air Force officer experience. But yeah, I mean, sort of broadly speaking, yeah. I mean, when you can think of someone who, because they played video games, aviation-oriented video games, for the entirety of their teenage years, between 11 and 18, and they show up, they enlist, and they're literally better at flying a drone than someone who has gone through the Air Force Academy. I certainly think that's a potential threat to how we conceive of officership in the United States Air Force. And that becomes sort of another way of approaching this sort of larger question about what role does the Air Force play? I mean, in the Army, the commanding officer is supposed to be better than his personnel at everything, but nobody believes that's true. There are always going to be enlisted personnel who run faster, who are able to carry more, et cetera, than the lieutenant. It does seem to, you know, at least the potential that people without significant professional training could be really experts at this air power thing is threatening to the conception of officership in the Air Force.
So I want to sort of transition to something. So the drone as an intelligence collecting platform is crazy. So I mean, I know that doesn't sound very academic, mm-hmm. but you know, the idea that you could put up a plane and sort of linger over an area for 36 to 48 hours, you know, is sort of insane mm-hmm. because, I mean, you know, plane-based surveillance used to be, you know, however a person could tolerate it. But, you know, with this ability to sort of collect for 48 hours at a time or however, you know, much the time span, you know, and to have really detailed information. So you're talking about, you know, HD, you know, surveillance to the point where you could, you know, pick out people, specific people in a village, and you're doing it for long, you know, periods of time. So I'm sort of curious, what does a drone do to the fog of war? You know, is it, are we moving from sort of the fog of war and the sort of misunderstandings that, you know, being in an active combat zone produces to almost an obsessive state where you have, you know, 72 hundreds of hours, you know, 72 to hundreds of thousands of hours of, you know, footage of, you know, basically footage that is intelligence or can be intelligence.
Right. I mean, I think that the best way, and so I do go on about this in the book, the best way to approach the question of what the fog of war means is not to think about it as the literal white cloud of smoke that would drift across the battlefield from whenever a Napoleonic army fired all of its weapons, right? That, you know, there is this sort of very originalist, literal way of thinking about the fog of war. And it's about literally you can't see the rest of the battlefield because there's this fog of gunpowder smoke. And it seems to me clear that this is not what Clausewitz is talking about, that he's talking about something more. And air power is for a long time, like one of the bugaboos has been, right, that we can cut through this fog of war, right? That eliminating the fog of war is really sort of a huge part of what air power is about, because you have to figure out what the right buttons are to push in an enemy society. But the point you bring up with respect to drones and the ability of information that they can collect, you know, puts a challenge to this, right? When you have all this information, how could there still be a fog of war when we have all this information from all of our drones sitting over the Taliban at all times? And I think the answer to that is that the fog of war happens in our heads and in our organizations as much as it does sort of in our sort of visibility of the battlefield, right? That what we can see, and this is not by no means a radical position. Having too much information can be as obscuring as having not any information at all, right? Because it's a difference between having information that's important and understanding which information is important. And so even with all of the intelligence and information that drones can deliver to a commander or to an analyst, sorting through that information to determine what's relevant, right, to determine whether the drone is seeing Taliban fighters or sheep herders, or, you know, sheep herders who are allied with Taliban fighters, is something that still falls within the fog of war. So the fog is still there. It's just displaced to a different area.
Interesting. So I asked you about politics and its relationship to air power, and the first part of our show, and I want to sort of re-ask that question, but as, you know, is there a tension between sort of, you know, the idea, the appearance of technical utility, right, and sort of the trappings of this idea that, you know, the higher tech something is, the more efficient it is at doing its job. So in the sense that, you know, does the use of drones, you know, sort of exacerbate this idea that, you know, air power is decisive?
Right. You know, I mean, I've gone back and forth on this. The case of drones makes this a very interesting question because, I mean, with drones, it seems almost to have operated the opposite way, that the novelty of drones, or the apparent novelty of drones, seems to have made them, in some sense, a less useful tool of policy. For reasons which remain sort of mysterious to me and absurd to me, people complain more when someone is killed by a drone than when they're killed by an F-16. And the novelty of the technology has this psychological impact that is completely outsized with the actual effect of the technology. And you have so much sort of badly written stuff about drones that's sort of just on this subject, right? That, oh, this is the first time that people were able to kill remotely. This is the first time that people were able to kill without having any, asymmetrically, without having any threat to themselves, which is just absurd, right? The whole concept of warfare is that we attempt to achieve advantage over our opponents before we fight them. And strangely enough, with drones, the very novelty, the idea that this is something new and technologically exciting and you know, sort of technologically different, seems to be threatening on a level that hasn't appeared in the rest of manned air power theory, right? That drones, you know, they're obviously useful for a variety of reasons, but the level of opprobrium with respect to the use of drones versus manned air power seems to be rendering them, you know, a lot less useful. A lot less useful than they maybe should be, sort of because of their novelty and the difference from the idea of a plane with a pilot in it.
I mean, why that hostility? I mean, it seems like, and I mean, to sort of to build on your point, I mean, it really does seem like that when an F-16 kills somebody or a Warthog that's A-10 Warthog that's being phased out kills somebody, you know, people, there isn't that outrage. And then you see a drone killing somebody, and there's this, you know, freak out. I mean, to even build on and to look at, you know, the experience on Twitter, you know, there's a lot of people, you know, stop the robot army, or, you know, gosh, I forgot, but, you know, people really take issue with drones. Mm-hmm. And so I'm curious, and I've sort of asked Kelsey and the drunken predator, his human co-pilot, you know, this question too, but I'm going to pose it to you. You know, why this fear and why this sort of treating drones as suspect and sort of shaking their fist at it versus manned planes versus manned, you know, more traditional sort of manned aircraft?
You know, I guess I'm not sure. I mean, I'd be curious the answer that they gave, but I'm not sure that I can give. It's a real phenomenon, right? And real phenomenon demand real explanations, right? Which is beyond the people are being idiots, right? Okay, but why are they being idiots, right? And so there must be something about drones that activates a different emotional response to the notion of air power, and you know. For the life of me, it's just a struggle for me to understand. I mean, the conventional explanations don't work. You know, a manned aircraft is under no threat from the people it's going to kill in the modern context, in the same way that a drone pilot is effectively under no threat. The idea of remotely killing from a tremendous distance, again, you know, a B-1B pilot kills from a tremendous distance when he or she drops a bomb on a group of Taliban insurgents. Right, it's a long way away, and there's a gulf between them. And so, I don't understand why the issue resonates, right? Why, when you shift to drones, it resonates in the way that manned air power doesn't resonate. And you know, I guess I just think that's a really good question, and I wish that I had better answers to it. I wish that I had a better understanding of why there was such a big difference.
I mean, do you think it has a lot to do with the sort of popular conception? Because it almost seems like, you know, in terms of sort of connotations, when I think manned airplanes, right? I think Top Gun,
right?
I think Tom Cruise and Val Kilmer and, you know, this very happy-go-lucky movie. And then when somebody, you know, says drone or unmanned aerial aircraft, I think a lot of people, their mind jumps to the Terminator,
right?
Or you know, Battlestar Galactica, you know, the Cylons. But I mean that's the only answer I can really give you, or maybe sort of propose, is the idea that it's the arguments seem to be more wrapped up in emotion and connotation rather than sort of evidence and sort of history. But I mean, that's the best thing I can come up with.
Right. I mean, and I think that's true, but it's still only half the answer, right? I mean, why should someone prefer to be killed by Maverick than by someone who is just sort of hanging out in Nevada and can go home to their wife? I mean, it's a struggle. It's a struggle for me to understand the opprobrium associated with drones. I wonder if it will persist. There's a possibility that it won't, but and I guess sort of when you talk about it in terms of the Top Gun versus Terminator question, I wonder if those particular associations matter for the people in Pakistan, who really do seem to assess a major difference between drone killings and other sorts of killings, right? I struggle with it from an air power perspective.
Well, I mean, maybe it's the intimacy of it, in the sense that, you know, an F-35 or a bomber, you know, you can't really see it or hear it. You only see the sort of the bomb, right? Mm-hmm. With the drone, it's, I mean, we've had people, you know, on the show who deal with Pakistan and Afghanistan, and it's, you know, the more famous, the Predator drone, it's, you know, a fixed wing aircraft. You hear it buzzing and you see it, and it's low altitude, and, you know, basically, death from above is you see the thing, and then you see it shoot the missile, and it's very this sort of visual play, and
right.
You know, the product of what's being of what's happening is being associated with, you know, the actor. But I mean, that's the best thing I could come up with. I mean, other than, I mean, and that view is very much from, you know, sort of the view of, you know, Pakistanis and sort of the people being targeted,
right.
You know, I still can't, you know, to your point, I still can't understand why, you know, somebody in the United States would, you know, have such a problem with drones versus sort of the manned aircraft.
Right.
You know, unless they're institutionally, you know, sort of drones are sort of taking their job, so to speak.
Right.
Anyway.
Right.
But I think we've covered everything today. Usually, I guess I keep forgetting that you're a first-time guest on the show. We always like to give the guest the sort of the last word and sort of something for the audience to sort of chew on, you know, to think about, you know, assuming they've gotten this far.
Mm-hmm.
So leave us with a last word and something to think about.
Right. I have two last words. First, if you're the sort of person who's sitting there and wondering who needs to be reading this book, who needs to be listening to this podcast, the people who need to be reading this book from my point of view are your Hill staffers who advise, your Congress critters who know nothing really about military affairs but who are sort of looking to get into the debate, right? That's who I want to read this book, right? The people in think tanks, the people who are in low-level advisory positions for congressmen and senators, but who are going to be able to contribute and say, oh, hey, you know, here might be a way to cut the defense budget. Here might be a way of restructuring. And so that's who I want to read this, right? People who aren't, you know, at the levers, the people who are at the levers of letters. And sort of my second point, and I want people to take this very seriously, is how should we best conceive of the institutions which are going to optimize our use of air power in really a sort of in context of a zombie plague. So with the rise of the zombies, if we're zombies were to emerge, how would we want air power to act? What sort of missions would it conduct, and how would it go about? You know, what would we want it to do? Is it close air support? Is it interdiction? Is it in theater air transport? I've talked to Dan Dresner about this question. And, you know, he's interested in it. He's written extensively about zombies. You know, I would love to have a Walking Dead episode about this very question. But that's also something that interests me.
Okay. Well, thank you so much for coming on. The book is Grounded, The Case for Abolishing the U.S. Air Force. We'll have a link up to the book, so make sure to check it out. It's a pretty good book, and it gets you thinking about stuff. So thank you so much for coming on.
Well, thanks for having me.
No problem.